And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to The Athletic Support, your podcast on the Montreal Canadiens by TheAthletic.com. I am Marc-Antoine Godin with Arpin Basu on this Wednesday, November 17th. Hello, Arpin.
Hey, buddy. How was New York?
New York was great. New York knows how to treat a person.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, so. and leave it alone, too. So that's the best of both worlds. So, that it was great. Madison Square Garden is a wonderful place to watch a hockey game, even though the crowd is not like too involved, and God knows it was far from being a full building yesterday.
Yeah, but it's not just 15,000 and change or something.
Oh man, that was not even there. That was not even 15,000.
Really?
I don't buy that. No, there were tons of empty seats, but the rink itself, it's you got to see that. You know, it has to be on people's bucket list. It's quite amazing.
It's also one of the best media vantage points in the league. The new press box in Madison Square. It used to be it was always actually one of the best. It was definitely unique in the past when we were in the corner of the rink.
Among the fans.
Yeah. But now the press box they have now is just spectacular. It's my favorite, I think, in the league in terms of press boxes.
Yeah, I agree. So one game in Boston, one game in New York. Obviously, by now, everybody knows the outcome of those two games. Canadiens only 4 wins in their first 18 games. Look, talking about the present might be a bit depressing. So we're going to look at the present, but slightly looking towards the future because I want to talk about the younger players on this team and the way to approach their development in a season like this where, you know, everything has gone
awry is what you're trying to say. Oh. Yeah. It's not pronounced the way it's spelled. I know it's a tricky word.
Gosh, I learn something new every day. That's good.
Yeah, that's right. Because it should be awry. Every day. It should be awry, but yeah. It's not. It's awry. Yeah.
All right.
But so, anyhow, further to that, you know, I think by now all of our listeners know that Matthias Norlander will be making his NHL debut on Thursday against his childhood idol, Sidney Crosby, and the Pittsburgh Penguins. And so, you know, that sort of led, you know, while you were flying back from New York, I was at practice on Wednesday today, and you know, just brought up this notion with Dominique Ducharme because, you know, let's be honest, 4 wins in 18 games and not a whole lot of, it's not as if they have a whole lot of loser points either. There's a lot of regulation losses in there. And so their chances of salvaging this season are slim to none. And, you know, if they can make me eat my words, then power to them. But it's almost a quarter of the season and they have 4 wins. So, you know, I thought at some point or at what point can Dominique Ducharme and his staff and management and everyone say, okay, it is what it is. Let's use this to our advantage and use this as a development year. So at what point does that switch flip? At what point and what does that look like? What does it look like when that switch flips? You know, already we see, you know, Ryan Poehling getting some sort of significant minutes, even as a fourth line center, but still he's starting to look more and more like an NHLer on this trip, on this stint up with the team.
Yeah.
Which is a positive. You have Nick Suzuki who went through a difficult start and, you know, notwithstanding the game in New York, has been pretty consistently good for a while now, which is a positive for the Canadiens as a young player. Now you have Norlander coming in. Romanov's been good. Cole Caulfield's still in Laval. So all these things, you know, the priorities for the Canadiens, I think, justifiably right now should change. I don't think Dominique Ducharme was quite on board with right now, but did concede that at one point, yes, they will have to start looking at things like that. So I did ask him about it, and I thought his answer was pretty interesting. And so this one was... We're going to play a couple of clips from him, but this one was actually the last thing where I just said, you know, to a certain extent, do you have to have a higher tolerance of mistakes mm-hmm. with younger players when wins and losses maybe aren't as important as that player's development? Let's listen to what he had to say.
Those mistakes sometimes comes because it's too much. Like you look at our situation right now and, you know, we're missing lots of guys. So guys end up they're not in the right chair. So instead of playing 11 minutes, for example, you play 15. Well, those 3-4 minutes put you in a situation where at one point, you know, you hang on, but then you crack. You're holding by the tip of your fingers and then you make a couple mistakes. And I think that's a lot of that. And with young players, same thing. Like, it's just, I understand what you're saying, but at the same time, that's the line between progressing and just hanging on. That's where you need to make sure that you do the right things for every young player, especially.
Why would the mistakes from younger players weigh more than the mistakes of veterans? You know, why would they be more significant? And because would they be more problematic to the team than if David Savard makes the same mistake or Tyler Toffoli same mistake?
Or Jeff Petrie.
Or Jeff Petrie for that matter. Because he's making more a lot than of his them. Fair share. Yeah.
Yes. Well, I think what his point is that maybe those mistakes... From his point of view, I think that maybe those mistakes are equally important to the mistakes that veterans make. Maybe veterans get more benefit of the doubt because of their track record. But I think his point is that there's not a real benefit to developing the young player if they're continuously making mistakes. If they're just mm-hmm. hanging on by their fingers, the way he said in that clip, you know, if they're just surviving in the NHL rather than being able to play, he doesn't see the benefits of that. And I think that's somewhat of a valid point. And I think Poehling's a perfect example of that. In his prior times,
He was surviving.
He was constantly a step behind everything. He was always trying to play catch up on the ice. And now you see him and he's right where he needs to be. He's following the pace of the game, the flow of the game. And as mentioned earlier, he looks like an NHL player. And so I think there's some validity to what he's saying, is that you can't just throw young guys out there and watch them drown and think that they'll be able to swim their way out of drowning. You know, I mean, that's really, I guess, the analogy that sort of works in this situation. You know, it's when you drown, you panic and you start wildly or when you fall in quicksand, let's say, and you're panicking and you're trying to get out. And the more you try to get out, the deeper you go. I think is sort of what Ducharme was saying there. And again, there's some validity to that. But I do also think there's some validity to the notion because, you know, when Kotkaniemi was sent down last season, we heard Joel Bouchard say it. He's going to make mistakes and we're going to keep throwing him out there. Cole Caulfield gets sent down this season. Jean-Francois, exact same thing. He's going to make mistakes. We're going to keep throwing him out there. So
yeah, exactly. He told me, he said, you know, when it comes to Caulfield, we want him to make his mistakes with us, not when he's with the Canadians. So let's let him have mistakes. That's fine. Like, get them out of his system.
Yeah, but I mean, by the same token, I fail to understand why you can do that in the AHL, but for some reason you can't do it in the NHL. And I get the whole, the NHL is not a development league story, but in the Canadians' current situation, why can't it be a development league? And why can't players make mistakes and get thrown back out there and shown confidence and say, listen, okay, you made a mistake, go out there and make up for it. And we have confidence in you, go out there and do it. I get it if they're struggling for 10, 12 games and there's just nothing's going on, kind of the way it was with Caulfield, that at that point it's a detriment and you can send them back down. Yeah. But generally speaking, and I think your point is super valid too, why is a young player's mistake so much worse than a veteran's mistake? I think for one thing, it's because the Canadians have the option with young players to send them to Laval, which they don't have with a David Savard or a Jeff Petrie. They just can't do that. But the other thing is that, you know, based on that answer from Ducharme, it's sort of seen as a detriment to their development as opposed to just simply a mistake that's costing the team on a given night.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, I understand that logic and it makes sense in a normal year, but when you have 4 wins in 18 games, you have to look at things differently. And when you say, well, he can make mistakes that will be costly to the team, well, what exactly, I mean, what's the cost at this point, or what do you have to lose? You know, under normal circumstances, you're fighting to stay in the hunt for the playoffs. Every point counts, et cetera, or you're in the thick of things. That's perfectly reasonable and valid. In this case, though, I think that if they become realistic with their own situation, then you could say, okay, well, we can afford those mistakes because we'll stop caring about the standings anyway. It's about playing the right way, as they like to say. And if it needs to be taught at a certain time at the NHL level or adjusted to the NHL opponent players too, well, you know, let them have it. It's probably the right time for that anyway. It's not to a certain extent, I mean, it's really looking this with a glass half full, but it's a luxury right now that they usually would not have. So, you know, use it up.
Yes. And so I think Norlander is actually an interesting case study in that, you know, like, because there's all sorts of other rules. You know, I mentioned earlier that they have the option to send down a Caulfield or even a Suzuki if they wanted to, or, you know, Romanov. Norlander is in a different situation. They can't send him to Laval. And so, you know, if they want to develop him on a North American ice surface, he's already played several years in Sweden at the top level with men, and has not necessarily done everything he can do there. There's still value to him going back to Sweden and having like a dominant season there, which he hasn't really had in the Swedish Hockey League. And so, but in his specific case, you know, there's a question to be asked. Like, you know, David Savard was asked today, you know, what you should do as a young player when you're making your debut. And his initial answer, and you hear this a lot, is just be yourself. The reason why you're getting this opportunity is because of what you've shown to date. So just do that. In Norlander's case, what he's done to date is be this sort of hybrid positionless player who roams all over the ice, is constantly dipping in and out of the offensive zone, is constantly looking for holes in the defense that he can exploit as a defenseman to jump in offensively. That's his identity. That's in his DNA. It's what makes him such an enticing prospect. But he's done that on a larger ice surface, playing a European style of hockey that maybe allows for that a little bit more. There's a bit more room for error in the European game just because of the size of the ice surface. You do have more time to recover from mistakes. So in his case, it's sort of an interesting dilemma in the sense that, you know, when Dominique Ducharme's asked what he expects to see from Matthias Norlander, he mentions, you know, just keep it simple. you know, and so when you're talking about Matthias Norlander, keep it simple means don't be yourself, basically. Don't use your instincts. And I think, you know, I mean, Dominique Ducharme mentioned it and just, you know, said for the first game, try and keep it simple, but, you know, pick your spots, know when to go, when not to. And it was actually interesting to hear him sort of comment on how much stronger physically Matthias Norlander is than he expected to see. And so that his defending is actually not maybe as big of a weakness as a lot of people would think, at least in Ducharme's eyes. So we'll see on Thursday against the Penguins, but it's going to be an interesting thing where if Norlander goes out at some point and is himself, as in takes a risk, jumps up into the play, tries to create something offensively, which is what he's good at, which is what he's known for, which is why he's here. Does he get, and it winds up costing them a goal. Does he get punished for that? Does he spend some time on the bench? I don't think so, but it kind of encapsulates what we're talking about here in the sense that if you want this guy to be at his best, you got to let him play, you know?
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Yeah, but you have to sell that to the whole team. And I don't know if the players as a group are ready to give up. You know, we look at it from, you know, from a distance, but within the locker room, even though it's ludicrous to think that you can come back and make the playoffs after such a dismal start, they won't want to recognize it. Not on November 17th. And managing a player like this, you know, if he shows to be not at the first mistake, but if over the course of his first game or first few games, he proves to be a liability at this point and a deterrent to the team potential, you know, winning some games, well, they might make decisions that's going to be based on the whole motivation of the team, which is still at this point in the season to win some games. So there's a management aspect to it. There's a coaching aspect to it, but it's also what's going to be accepted. There has to be an understanding with the players of if there is going to be a shift in the priorities and the way that this team is coached and is prepared. Everybody's got to be on board with that.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, listen, we've been through this before. I mean, the 2017-18 season, all the comparisons have been made. They all apply. This is just as dismal a situation. I would say the Canadians are probably playing a little bit better right now than they were at the same stage in that season, although they did whip off a pretty long winning streak right around now in that season 4 years ago.
It's the last time they won 5 games in a row.
Right. Yeah, it was. Yeah. So, you know, that was, I think, shortly after Max Pacioretty sort of you know, kind of gushed about how badly he was playing and how he was having difficulty being a captain because of how bad he was playing and how he couldn't tell anyone else to play better when he was so bad. And then I think he went on a ridiculous goal scoring run right after that. But, and you know, I was telling you this week, you know, that this team is probably going to do that at some point. They probably will. They're not going to lose four out of every 18 games. They're not going to win only four out of every 18 games all season. They're going to, I'm sure at some point they will whip off a few wins in a row and, you know, things will look a little bit less dismal just because every team does that at some point. You know, even the worst team goes on little 2-3, maybe even 4-game winning streaks. It happens. And I don't think they're this bad of a team. I would imagine at some point they will whip off some wins. But the question is, you know, and to your point, Brendan Gallagher today, like, it's, you know, there's mention noting that, you know, they don't have tons of time, but you said there's lots of time for us to get things back on track, which is the way players will look at it, because they'll look at, even though they've played 18 games, they're looking at it that, you know, there's 64 left. Let's win 50 out of those 64. Sure we can. Why not? You know, that's how athletes are wired. They're not wired to think of necessarily look at situations in the most realistic ways possible, but that's what management's job is. And to a certain extent, that's what the coaching staff's job is. So I get what you're saying, that they'd have to sell that to the players. But I think at a certain point, especially the guys who are going to be here a while, like a Gallagher, like a Toffoli, like an Anderson, like a Petrie, like, you know, all these guys who are signed long-term, if they can see how, let's say, Norlander or eventually a Caulfield or a Poehling, if giving them extra minutes, you know, the way Ducharme talked about, those minutes that lead to mistakes, if they can see a long-term benefit in that, maybe that's an easier sell, because this is not a typical, you know, this is not a situation like the one they have in Arizona where they're bad by design, and that, you know, no one's sort of, you know, invested in that team. The players who are on that team aren't really invested in the short to medium term success of the team. You know, a lot of those guys are going to be gone by the time Arizona's any good. That's not the case here in Montreal. It's very different. So, which is what makes this whole situation a lot more difficult to fix. But by the same token, it does make that sell job a lot easier to the players on the team to say, hey, listen, if we can get this guy some reps in the NHL, look at the skill set he has. So if we could just work those mistakes out of his game, but at this level, in the long run, it'll be good for us, which means it'll be good for you since you're going to be here for 3 more years.
Yeah. Well, an example of the sort of decision that they might have to do with, if they want to, you know, give some reps to Norlander, you know, at practice on Wednesday, he was paired with Savard, and you had Romanov with Kulak. Yesterday on Tuesday in New York, second and third pairing played roughly the same amount. And Kulak has been, he didn't play much against the Rangers, but prior to that, he was getting like a decent amount of ice time. But now we're starting to see the potential return of Joel Edmundson, who might be at morning skate on Saturday. So eventually, before long, they'll want to, you know, to add Edmundson to their decor, who badly needs him. But then you need to take, if you want to keep Norlander in, you have to take a Kulak out. You have to, you have to choose between Norlander and Romanov. Will you take a veteran out? There's just to fit in Edmundson and keep Norlander in there. So that's why also in terms of roster or, roster decisions and spot allocation, just keeping this kid in the lineup and say we're going to let him develop in Montreal, it will come at the expense of somebody else, somebody more meaningful than just Weidman or Nikku, which is the case, you know, for these few days. So,
yeah, no, that's an excellent point. And but you know, this is a situation where maybe you can see if there's any interest in Kulak around the league. Like that's. Mm-hmm. If that's, you know, if that's what's stopping you, first of all, I don't think they would lose any sleep over, you know, having Kulak in the stands for a few games, just to give some guys a look, but I, your point's extremely valid because it does become a situation where if you have to put a veteran out, like, you know, taking Romanov out and putting Norlander there doesn't accomplish anything. You know, you're not really,
I know.
You need both. You want both of them in if development has become your priority all of a sudden. You know, when Edmondson's back, Sherratt and Edmondson are taking up two of the spots on the left side. If they insist on playing Norlander on the left, which I think they will, then, and they want Romanov to play on the left, which I think they will, it becomes tricky. But, you know, we might be getting a little bit ahead of ourselves because we have to see how Norlander does. So in his specific case, maybe this is all moot. Maybe he shows that he really can't handle it in the NHL right now and he winds up back in Sweden like next week or something. That's a possibility. But, you know, generally as a team philosophy, you know, I think if you look at Cole Caulfield, let's say at some point, let's say he puts up a bunch of, well, let's say he plays in the AHL the way he did last year when he was first there, you know, and just starts putting up goals and just starts making it clear that he's too good for that level. You know, when you bring him back up, you know, there's clearly a right now, because of all the injuries, there's clearly a top six and a bottom six on this team, which was not the plan. You know, the plan was to have sort of a top nine full of, you know, three offensive lines and then having a fourth line that looks like the Evans, Lehkonen, Armia line right now. But the way things stand currently, you know, which winger would you take? Would you move down to the third line to accommodate Caulfield, or does Caulfield go onto the third line? And is that the best for his development? You know, there's all sorts of questions that the Canadians need to ask themselves. And it's a little early. It's November 17th, as you mentioned. It's a little early to be thinking about these things as opposed to thinking about winning your next game and putting together a win streak and getting back in the playoff race. But, you know, I think, and this is the other complicating factor, is that, you know, management's in a state of total flux. Like, Marc Bergevin probably knows that barring some sort of, you know, 180 degree turn from Jeff Molson, that he's probably in his last year as general manager. And perhaps as a result, Dominique Ducharme doesn't really know what to expect. If a new general manager comes in, it would be only natural for the coach to wonder if he's going to be kept around. So there's also that factor.
Yeah.
I don't know how much do you think that factors into any of this, in the sense that when neither management nor the coaching staff have any assurance that they will be here next season, does development, is it easy to chalk up a season to a development year when it could be your last year there?
Well, I don't think it is going to change anything when it comes to Dominique Ducharme. I think that he's got a 3-year contract in hand. He might be fired, but so can any coach, you know? So at any given point, so until you're fired, you better make decisions that you've chosen to make instead of either, you know, trying to please the person above you or trying to play safe in order to save your job. One thing about Dominique Ducharme is that I feel as though he's a very confident man, very steady, very even keel. Even just in his interactions with the media, he is so consistent in the way that he delivers his message, in his mood also. I think that it's his visiting card it's what he sells. It's an even keel person that, you know, that famous cliche of never too high, never too low that's asked of every player. Well, he shows it as a coach, and that's what he preaches, and he practices it too. So I don't think that all these considerations that might look like a distraction from the outside are going to change anything for him. For Marc Bergevin, it's a very different story, because he always claimed that, A, that he had the full flexibility to do whatever he thinks needs to be done. And going back to prior to the reset, he said, I'm going to keep doing what's best for the team short-term and long-term and make decisions that are going to impact the team positively even after I'm gone. So if we take him to his word, and he's got that flexibility, knowing that there's a very significant possibility that he might not come back next season. Well, he needs to make the moves that need to be made, thinking, okay, well, if it was somebody else than me, that person would still probably make the same decisions than I do. And if they don't, well, who cares? I'm the one sitting in this chair right now. And I'm still hired and paid to be the general manager. And what I think the best for this team now is X, Y, Z. And I think it should involve trading some contracts, and it should involve giving a better place to younger players. Is it what they're going to do? I don't know. But I think that's, if they're being honest in the long-term care of this team, that's what Marc Bergevin should be doing.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with that. And it's you know, a coach is always going to coach to win hockey games. It doesn't matter if they're out of the playoffs. It doesn't matter, you know, it doesn't matter the scenario. I mean, maybe certain lineup decisions can change based on the current reality. But you know what? I mean, I think Dominique Ducharme should get a chance to sort of answer this question. The initial question when he was asked about whether he can, at what point he can look at this as a development year and not worry so much about wins and losses. And this is what he had to say.
I don't know, maybe at some point, but every situation is different. Every player is different. And sometimes with a young guy, when he's just playing and trying to survive in the league, I don't think he's progressing as much as playing somewhere else, for example. So that's where the line is in the progression. I think it's important that if you're only playing and trying to survive in the league, I don't think it helps you that much. So that's something that we evaluate with young guys all the time.
So there it is. That's Dominique Ducharme's perspective on this thing. I think the one thing that's worth noting is that he didn't find the question like offensive or completely out of left field. He understood. Like he understands why these questions are being asked, because the standings, you know, their hope of climbing the standings is at 0.01% right now. And he gets that. You know, they're gonna have to do something extremely unlikely for that to change. But he understands the reasoning behind it. And listen, he was made coach partially because of his ability to work with young players. You know, I mean, you know, Nathan MacKinnon swears by him. He's developed a lot of guys at the junior ranks and is relates well with the younger generation of players. I think that's fair to say. Although I don't know, maybe Jesperi Kotkaniemi would disagree with that, but other than that, I think he's able to relate with young players. But to me, you know, there is that your initial point about why is a mistake for a young player less acceptable than a mistake from an older player. I think maybe we should talk about some of those older players right now. You know, at the beginning of the season, you know, you and I collaborated on a feature, you know, identifying Nick Suzuki and Jeff Petrie, two guys sort of at the opposite ends of their careers, but two guys who are being asked to sort of step into or emerge into sort of a leading role on their respective positions. Nick Suzuki's, you know, aside from some ups and downs at certain points, but basically for a good chunk of the season, he's done that. Jeff Petrie is not. And I feel like we should talk about it because it's really probably, I think, the number one factor in how badly the Canadians have gotten, are playing right now and how bad the results have been. Because when they talk about, you know, we hear Dominique Ducharme talk all the time about it's execution. He says it every game.
Yeah.
We just need to execute, which, you know, is normal for a coach to say, because he's not going to come out and say, well, my system's terrible, so that's why we're losing. You know, he's going to blame it on execution. And I think it's visible in the Canadiens game that they do go through long stretches where they miss passes, they miss assignments. And, you know, just as an example, that game in New York, you know, after the game, Dominique Ducharme sort of described this goal as being, you know, it was a fortunate rebound, got past our first layer of guys. They kind of pick it up and come down on an odd man rush. But man, if you look at Jeff Petrie on that, I believe it was Chris Kreider who scored behind him.
Yes.
A perfect pass from Mika Zibanejad. And just watch Jeff Petrie, and he is dans la lune. Like, he is not paying attention to what he's supposed to be doing at all. Chris Kreider might as well have not been there the way he played that play. Like, he might as well
He never gave him a look.
He watched the puck the entire time.
Absolutely. And he didn't even skate it fast enough or position his stick in order to really have a good chance of stopping that puck, too. So it was neither one or the other. It was just not there. And it's funny because they tried the same play. A different line tried the same play a little bit later. I think it was, who was it? But anyway, this time around, Petrie skated a little bit faster and just managed to tip the puck, tip the pass with his stick and deflected so that the Rangers forward could not bury that other chance. But I mean, on that goal, the Kreider goal, it's all on Petrie. I mean, you know, counterattack, rushes, whatnot. Yeah, sure, they're talented. They're going to, you know, generate out of their zone entries. But ultimately, if your defenseman is covering the guy he's meant to cover, it becomes just either a shot from an angle that's favorable for the goalie, or you got a defenseman there that's, you know, that's ready to react. But I mean, he's responsible for that goal and the turnovers too. In the first period, it was ridiculous.
Yeah,
and I don't know to which extent, you know, we hear that he might, you know, he might play hurt. A few guys on this team right now are playing hurt. When you look at the list of guys that are already injured, if you had to give a break to those who are playing hurt, I mean, I'm not sure if you'd have enough bodies in Trois-Rivières to fill that team in Montreal.
But all players say if they're in uniform, then they're held to the standard of
that they
normally would be. If they're able to play, if they're able to
they're
suit
fit
up,
to play.
Then, yeah,
they're fit to play. It.
And so they should be judged as such. Yeah.
Exactly. But it's been a nightmarish season so far for Jeff Petrie. And you were mentioning how our, you know, a beginning of season article or feature on those two guys, Petrie was well aware of what was expected of him, what was waiting for him with Shea Weber, you know, being out, being gone. And what's weird is that in the past, he would step up and raise his level of play every time that Weber was not there. And this time, his game has collapsed in a way that we had not. I mean, he's had some ups and downs, especially in his first few years in Montreal, but not to that extent. I mean, right now he plays like the guy. I mean, I won't name him, but I remember a colleague from Edmonton. I was covering a board of governors meeting in Florida, and he said, "Really? Jeff Petrie? You guys gave that contract to Jeff Petrie?" Like, because what he had seen of him was just, it was puzzling that the Canadiens were trusting Petrie so much. And rightfully so, they did trust him because he developed into a great defenseman. But right now, he's reverting back to the way he was playing with Edmonton, sadly. So, I mean, he's got to figure it out. Because otherwise, you know, not... Because so many guys already on the Canadiens are playing out of their usual spot, and things are being asked of them that would not in normal times. But what's being asked of Petrie is exactly what he was expecting. And if he doesn't deliver, well, then there's a domino effect that makes things worse for everybody else.
Yes, absolutely. Like, he is not, you know, and Ducharme mentioned it today, how people are not in the right chair. You know, we heard it in that clip. So that means young players are expected to do more, but you're exactly right. Jeff Petrie's playing in a role that everyone expected him to play, that he himself not only expected to play, but he was looking forward to playing. You know, I mean, I think we can mention a little bit how the sausage is made. You know, you spoke to Nick Suzuki for that feature. I spoke to Jeff Petrie for that feature, you know, one-on-one with each guy, and we collaborated to write the story. But I can share that, you know, it took some, it was funny. Like, I asked Petrie about you know, embracing this opportunity to a certain extent. No one's happy that Shea Weber's not there, least of all Jeff Petrie. But, you know, for the first time, he's the man. He's the guy. He's the number one defenseman on this team. It's not disputed. There's no way you can get around that fact. That's just a fact. And I want to know if that excited him or if any piece of that, if he's ever kind of wanted that. And, you know, he kind of tiptoed around it and didn't really want to go there. And then later in the interview, all on his own, he went back to that and was like, you know, I am looking forward to that. Like I do want that. It's, you know, I mean, and I'll read the quote, you know, just because it's, I think I look forward to the opportunities with Shea not being here and the increased responsibility. I look forward to that opportunity. And unfortunately, we've kind of been in a position the last couple of years with Shea out, and I've had to step into that for parts of seasons and things like that. So it's nice, I guess, that I've had that experience. It's a bigger responsibility, but like I said, it's not going to be on one guy, blah, 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 blah. So there was this acknowledgement that he's stepping into a role on a permanent basis that he'd only done on a part-time temporary basis in the past. And that excited him, but I think it was pretty revealing when Jeff had strung together, you know, maybe two or three games that were pretty good earlier this season, and he sort of talked about his start to the season and how he put extra pressure on himself. He was trying to do too much. He was trying to do things that were not natural to him, that were not part of his natural game, and that's what was getting him in trouble. And I think at the time that was true, but now what we're seeing, you know, like that goal in New York, not to harp on it, is one mistake and it happens. But it's really the only reason we bring it up and the only reason we're talking about it is because it's become somewhat typical of things that Petrie is doing from on a game-to-game basis. It's not necessarily a matter of him doing too much or playing outside of his skill set or his natural game. It's a matter of him just making,
or a byproduct of too much ice time, which
could be. I mean, it's because they're mental errors, right? They're lapses in judgment, and maybe the increased ice time leads to that. Maybe the heavy workload can lead to some mental exhaustion and get. But it's not as if he's getting ice time that he's never seen before. He's played 25 minutes a game before in the past. It's not unreasonable for him to play that much, and he's thrived with those minutes in the past. So it's really something the Canadians need to figure out, something that Jeff Petrie needs to figure out. And Ducharme was asked about it point blank on Wednesday and mentioned Edmondson not being there, Weber not being there. So added responsibility, doesn't have his partner, this, that, all sorts of probably valid, but still excuses for why Petrie's playing so poorly. And, you know, it is something that I think Jeff will need to get his head around pretty quickly, not to save the season or anything, but just to prove to himself and to prove to everyone that this is just a rough stretch. It's a slump, and that he can get out of it and become the real consistent performer that he's been for several years now in Montreal.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
Which little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Yeah. I think there's been few indications that things were not entirely right. When they decided to take him off the first power play, and give it to Chris Weidman. It's like, really? Okay. I mean, on one hand, you went out to get Weidman and you bothered to put him in your lineup. He's a power play specialist. If you're not going to use him on the power play, well, might as well not play him. I understand that part. But Jeff Petrie, for all that's been said and written on social media, how he would ignore Cole Caulfield at the beginning of the season and ignore passing options and instead shooting from, you know, low percentage type of shots. I understand that, but you want to give a guy like that who's so important to your team, you want to give him the tools to get his groove back. I mean, he's the most offensive oriented defenseman they've got. He's mobile. He's a key to their transition game, and right now it's just not happening. With two assists in 18 games, that's just not going to cut it. I mean, he's Jeff Petrie. He's not Alexei Yemelin.
No, exactly. And I'm with you on the power play thing. I mean, we'll see. We're going to see on Thursday, actually. The one thing Ducharme confirmed was that, you know, Norlander will probably see some time on the power play, but he's not necessarily going to step into Weidman's spot on the first unit, which would suggest to me that Jeff Petrie is going to get another shot to reclaim that job. And you know, this kind of goes back to your initial question at the start of the podcast. You know, why are mistakes by younger players less tolerated than mistakes by older players? Well, I think Jeff Petrie being taken off the top power play unit is an example of the coaching staff not tolerating a veteran's mistakes. You know, they objectively looked at it, and I don't think they were incorrect in their assessment that Chris Weidman, the power play flows better with Chris Weidman at the top than with Jeff Petrie at the top. And that shouldn't be the case, because for years now, and the irony in this, actually, when you think about it, so for the last several years, Jeff Petrie has clearly been the Canadiens' best option at the top of their power play, and yet they insisted on keeping Shea Weber there. Through hell and high water, the power play could be going terribly. Shea Weber could be not contributing at all on the power play, which he didn't, by and large, for massive stretches of the last few seasons. It was clear to everyone that the power play was much better with Jeff Petrie on it than it was with Shea Weber. And yet, Shea Weber continued getting the benefit of the doubt for years. Jeff Petrie goes through a bad month on the power play and he's gone. It's like immediately. So it's a bit of an ironic thing there. Yeah. I mean, it's...
And perhaps, you know, perhaps also it's there's load management or ice time management behind that. Because I think that he's a guy, if they could find a way to, you know, to give more ice time to Romanov on the PK and try to take Petrie off the PK and give him more power play time, that would probably be a better balance of things. But it's the opposite that we're seeing. Petrie is leaned on heavily on the PK along with Sherratt, but, you know, technically Savard should be a guy that's reliable to play on the PK. Romanov, I think he's settled down and he's not as bad as the numbers suggest on the PK. So they've got other options there. Where they're you know, on the power play, yes, Weidman was definitely an option there, but otherwise it's rather slim picking. So we'll see what's going to happen. But that, you know, you mentioned earlier the fact that the Canadiens have now, because of all the injuries, a top six, bottom six. But whereas they wanted to spread out their offense a lot more at the beginning of the season, but on the power play, they wanted to have two balanced units. And right now, you clearly have one big unit that gets the chunk of the ice time compared to the second unit. So we'll see. I mean, this is. Guys will, I suppose that at some point, guys will stop getting injured and we'll start seeing some bodies back, you know, whether it's Perreault or Hoffman and eventually Byron. But you're gonna have guys that'll come back and potentially bringing that balance back. And I know that we've switched topics here, but because we discussed so for so long on Norlinder, but I think that a guy like Paling, you know, we've seen the Canadiens lost to Adam Brooks on waivers. They made a decision to go with a youngster in favor of a guy that they had picked up on waivers. And if they intend to keep Paling, well, eventually, if you've got those guys back, and Paling could end up being flanked by the same wingers are playing with Evans now, Lekkonen and Armia, that could be a great learning curve for him and a great adaptation to the NHL to have that sort of wingers to play with him in the bottom six. So, I'll let you figure out a way to reconnect that to where we were in the discussion, but I wanted to bring that point on.
Yeah. It speaks to balance. You know what I mean? I think like Dominique Ducharme, I think we had it in our notebook, when he was asked last week about Arturi Lekkonen and his ability to provide offense, he brought up Armia as well and said, we need production from those guys. Like it was clear in his answer that the plan at the beginning of the year and all this time when he was talking about having a fourth line that can play against anyone and pitch in offensively and do that, he was talking about Lekkonen, Evans, and Armia. Or Lekkonen, Paling, and Armia if Paling had proven himself capable of that job in training camp. But Lekkonen and Armia being kind of the centerpieces of that, their luxury, the luxury fourth line of the team that can sort of feast on opposing fourth lines and really provide some goals for a balanced attack. To sort of dovetail and I guess segue from that, another big component of the balanced attack was going to be Christian Dvorak and his ability to be a factor on the power play, win faceoffs and score power play goals, which he'd shown an ability to do in Arizona, and provide a good, solid two-way threat that they lost in Philip Danault. But with playing with good wingers, started the season with Jonathan Drouin, and Josh Anderson was back with them against New York with the return of Drouin, obviously, but that line had been broken up before Drouin even got hurt. Christian Dvorak got off to a great start this season and then totally fell off a cliff and became almost a non-factor on many nights before scoring against New York. So he's a tough one to kind of peg because I feel like he still does, he's another one of those little things guys. Like you can see things on the ice that he does effectively that help the Canadiens, but offensively it's just not happening for him. And they need that. I mean, that's the whole plan offensively for the team was based on having four lines that can produce. And right now they're not getting that from Dvorak. But I still feel he's not playing that badly. So I don't know how to sort of reconcile the two things.
Yeah. It's just when you say he had a great start to the season, I mean, the first four or five games, he was probably their best forward. Nobody was playing well, but he was playing well. But the
and
problem
his
is...
His line was playing well. I think Anderson and Drouin were playing well, too, at that time. Yeah.
Yes, that's true. But then the Canadiens played twice against the LA Kings. The comparisons with Philip Danault were waiting to be debated. And I think that it's more and more obvious that despite the fact that you can separate all the elements of those two guys' games, the aspects that they bring to a team and their strength on the ice, you can dissect that. When you put it together, it gives you two different players that really contribute very differently to their team. And if the Canadiens thought that they could replace Danault and say, we're going to have a similar player to Danault by getting Dvorak. Well, I think that they were mistaken because there are things that Dvorak does very well. I think he's extremely reliable on faceoffs. He's a decent penalty killer. But the big, big problem that I see is that he does not generate offense with foot speed, with his transition. And yesterday morning, when it was discussed with Ducharme that the Drouin would be coming back and inserted on Dvorak's left, he said, "Yeah, well, Joe, what he's able to do with the puck, we know he can create a lot of plays when he's active, and at the same time, it could simplify the work of a guy like Dvorak who needs to play less with the puck.
Mm-hmm.
So here you got a centerman that needs to play less with the puck. That's, to me, that's unusual. And when you have the type of wingers that the Canadians have, Drouin is probably the only winger that they have that, you know, you could say he's a playmaking winger. And then again, I don't see him very motivated in carrying the puck a great deal night after night. So the fit, there are certain aspects of Dvorak's game. Yeah, he sort of replaced Dano, but the whole transition, killing plays in the neutral zone, creating turnovers, going the other way, he's just not providing that. And he becomes, the minute that the puck is out of the Canadiens' end, he becomes the equivalent to a winger. He's trying to crash the net and be there for tips and whatnot. And for him, those occasions have not been there. He has not buried them. And for that reason, he admitted after the game that he's disappointed with himself because he would like to contribute more. And he's putting pressure on himself to produce. But right now, all those, you know, those goals around the net are not coming for him. So when you look at the process and the results, well, right now, I don't see a process that's very convincing on his end, but especially the results are just not happening. And he was supposed to be a power play contributor, but the Canadians, even though he's a guy that's effective at the bumper position, the Canadians are not able to figure out how to properly use a bumper. Whether it's him, whether it's Toffoli, whoever else, it could be Connor McDavid or Leon Draisaitl. It seems as though it's not a role that they have learned to use properly.
No, I mean, he has 2 points on the power play this year. You know, I don't like mentioning plus minus as a stat in general, but when you're minus 15 after 18 games. I know that he had a minus 5 in there in one game, so, you know, take that for what it's worth. But still, it's not something you would want from a guy who is supposed to be a pseudo Dano replacement. That's, not sure. And remember that the Arizona Coyotes are getting a first-round pick in this draft because they traded Christian Dvorak to Montreal. So, which kind of brings us full circle to finish off the podcast. But, you know, another reason that maybe using this as a development year would be a good thing is that if the Canadians can keep their draft pick in the top 10, they get to keep it. And they would avoid sending, say, the 12th or 13th overall pick to Arizona to complete the Christian Dvorak deal. But listen, let's leave it at that. Let's see what happens on Thursday night with Matthias Norlander. You know, watch the continued development of Ryan Poehling. I mean, this is really what this season is going to become about. Caden Primo had a great game in New York. Canadians didn't really come out of the gates trying to protect them a whole lot, giving up, 17 shots in the first period and playing just terribly. Dominique Ducharme didn't confirm it today, but I'd be pretty stunned if Caden Primo wasn't starting on Thursday. So that's another example of giving a young guy an opportunity and if the Canadians are smart about it and are able to be honest with themselves, you know, the things like Norlander playing, Primo playing, Poehling, Evans, even, we haven't mentioned his name, but getting him some more significant ice time, Suzuki, all these things, Caulfield eventually has to become a priority for this club, how they go about doing it. I think we've discussed en masse during this podcast, but it's going to be very interesting to watch how they manage that going forward from this point, because I don't think watching the standings is very productive for anyone involved in this, either as fans or media or the players and coaches themselves. There's some other priorities that need to take hold here.
Yeah, I know. Cause when I look at the standings, they play for 278. I wrote in my article, in my piece last night, that at that point, it's not a win percentage anymore or a win average. It's a batting average in baseball. Yes. No, 278.
Not even a great batting average.
No, it's very. You're Tim just kind Wallach.
Of a, yeah. Yeah, you're just kind of a solid every day. Like, you better have a good glove if you're hitting 278. Like, you better be a hell of a fielder to be in there every night. So
the Canadians played for less than 300 once in their history in 39-40. So
oh really?
Yeah, and I don't see Maurice Richard in the pipeline just waiting to be called up. So
no, but I don't think I really, again, and I think people might be crazy, but I don't think this team is a 278 team.
No.
I would imagine they will go on a run at some point. I'm convinced of it. What I think in the context of our conversation here is that the Canadiens can't let that run cloud their judgment to all the things we talked about today, in my opinion. Like, they need to keep that in perspective and not let, if the Canadiens whip off four wins in a row, they can't let themselves think that that's all of a sudden that they're headed back to towards a playoff contention here. It's not going to happen. They need like four or five game winning streaks. While you're having a four game winning streak, the teams around you are winning as well. It's not necessarily that they're all losing while you're winning. So a four game winning streak might get you 2 points closer to a playoff spot, three, maybe. Like, it takes a lot to make up ground, in the National Parity League. And so, you know, if they do decide to go and invest this season's time in development, here's hoping that they don't let, you know, the inevitable winning streak that will come at some point, cloud their judgment and move away from that. But we'll see it when it comes, if it comes. I think it will, but we're not going to, you know, we can't know how they would behave during a winning streak until they actually have one.
But, you know, Arpin, I know everybody is saying, oh, it's a long season. It's going to be a long season. And even some people who are subscribers to The Athletic say, oh, I pity you for covering that team on a daily basis and writing about them. But you know what? I think that this is a defining moment in the Canadiens, not their history, but the next few months are going to be, they might define the next generation of the Montreal Canadiens. The set of roster decisions, the managerial decisions that will be made, the fate of Marc Bergevin, how Jeff Molson is going to approach the whole thing. To me, it's going to be fascinating because there are opportunities to be taken for that team to say, you know what, we're turning the page and we're going to make a major, I don't know how to say in English, but a major coup de barre, you know, and if they choose, if they're timid about it and they're tiptoeing their way and they're telling themselves stories, well, it's going to be more of the same for a number of years. But if they're willing to take the hard decisions, we could enter a very fascinating time for the Canadiens, and I'm here for that.
Let's leave it at that. I think I'm here for it too. I think that's very well said. So let's leave it at that. We'll be back next Wednesday in French with Le Support Athletic. And a reminder to everyone, if you have not subscribed to The Athletic, you can do so at theathletic.com/athletic support to get a discount on your first year subscription. But ahead of next week's French episode, I'm now going to go look up what coup de barre means. But until then, I will speak to you all. We'll speak to you all next week. I will actually be on the road at that point. I'll fill you in on where I'll be a bit later. But we'll talk to you Wednesday on Le Sport Athletic. Have a good week.
Bye-bye, everybody.